From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Judy Campbell in for Michael Krasny. Remember chocolate molten lava cake? It used to be everywhere. If it's still somewhere, it's probably still delicious. But instead, we've moved on to cake pops, macaroons, cronuts, craggles, and caramel with sea salt. How and why do food trends happen? How does a nation lose its taste for muffins and develop a taste for toast? Are we on a path to better, healthier, tastier food? Or are we just wasting our time and money careening from new to new? We'll talk food trends with David Sachs, author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue, next after this. From KQED Public Radio, welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell. About a year ago, a friend of mine discovered she loved raw kale. She researched different ways to prepare it, soften it, found some complimentary flavors to add, and proudly marched her new kale salad to a party, where it sat on a table next to seven other kale salads. How do these food trends happen seemingly overnight? How is it that a baker can come up with an idea for a new product, say a cronut, and on the day it debuts at his bakery, it sells out in half an hour? Are food trends happening organically, or is it some meeting that took place in a corporate boardroom that's causing you to wait 2 hours in a food truck line for bacon-wrapped candied bacon with bacon salt? David Sachs has boldly gone out snacking through the food world, researching food trends, and his book, Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Welcome, David Sachs.
Hi, Judy.
Well, let's start with that bacon story, because bacon seems beyond a trend. It seems to be in cult territory now.
Yeah, it's become not only a culinary trend, but I think a cultural trend. Mm-hmm. When people start wearing T-shirts and slapping bumper stickers on their cars.
People are very proud of liking bacon.
Yeah, exactly. Bacon, everything's better with bacon. You know, people have tattoos of pigs on their arms and bacon tattoos. So it's sort of the food trend that has entered this status as, you know, it's a cultural symbol. It's a way that people identify who they are and what they love and what they prioritize.
Well, what does it say? What do you think bacon says?
Kale's the same.
Uh-huh.
You know, bacon is, you know, it's a very sort of macho food trend. It's a food trend of indulgence and sort of carnivorous excess, right? It's the great American food trend. It's the tailgating food trend. It's the football party food trend.
It is not the same as the kale trend.
No, the kale trend is the virtuous food trend. You know, the kale trend's bumper stickers are slapped on the back of Priuses, which is, you know, I'm sure all over the Bay Area you see them, whereas the bacon trend is found not only on pickup trucks and SUVs, but also on Priuses as well.
Sometimes right, right.
Next bacon, to the kale trend.
Bacon yeah. does bridge the partisan divide, doesn't it? Bacon seems to be.
As does kale. I mean, you know, a kale salad with bacon is infinitely improved.
Well, tell the story of bacon, though, because this is one of the stories that there is a real industry component to why bacon became so big.
Yeah, you know, the bacon food trend was almost a reaction by the pork industry to the low-fat diet trend of the 1980s, which drove down consumption of bacon and sort of fatty cuts of pork because people were afraid of eating fat and saturated fat, and it was, you know, terrible for you. A slice of bacon would kill you. And the price of pork belly as a commodity was down so low that farmers who – you know, hog farmers, pork farmers were losing a lot of money. And they said to their industry representatives in Iowa, do something about this. Find some way to drum up demand for bacon because we're getting slaughtered here.
Because they had all this extra, this whole part of the pig that was selling much slower than the lean pork products.
And
which
they were focusing. Yeah, exactly. They were focusing on pork, the other white meat, which was their campaign that basically said, you know, hey, this is just a chicken with four legs. It's a pink chicken with four legs. It's just like a chicken breast. It's great for you. It's super lean and low fat. And, you know, don't worry about the bacon. Don't worry about the other parts. But that part happened to be one of the biggest cuts on the animal. And so it dragged down the price of the carcass, as one pork industry person told me. And what they did was, you know, at the National Pork Board, or what was then called the Pork Marketing Board, they figured out, okay, who is going to buy bacon? Who can we sell bacon to in enough of a quantity that it's going to move the needle in terms of price? And what they realized was, you know, the fast food chains, the hamburger chains, they always wanted bacon, but it was too much of a hassle. It was too greasy. It created too much smoke. It was just too messy and difficult to cook. But if they could deliver a way to sort of have pre-cooked bacon that was easy to reheat and anybody could do it without smoke or mess or grease traps, then those fast food companies would be all over it, because they were selling chicken breast sandwiches and lean burgers that, frankly, didn't have a lot of taste. You know, you take an extra lean burger and you cook it well done, as they do in the fast food business. You know, it's a piece of cardboard between two buns. So what the pork industry did was they funded experiments and initiatives at different universities and agricultural schools and companies to develop this round pre-cooked bacon that could be heated in a convection oven or a microwave at a fast food restaurant and go onto a burger. And then what they did was they worked with those fast food chains and restaurant chains like Burger King and Wendy's and Denny's to develop menu items that could feature bacon prominently and that would actually work. And they, you know, helped – they paid to sort of market it, and they paid to test market it in different markets and paid for recipe development. And, you know, we're not talking about huge sums of money here, maybe a couple $100,000. But what it did was it started introducing bacon products or products with bacon on them to these fast food chains. And it took off because the bacon on the sandwich was – you know, a delicious addition that for an extra dollar, people were lining up for. And slowly, as they realized that this was selling, the fast food company started putting more bacon on their products and adding more products with bacon on them until you get to the point where it's like the new, you know, Burger King bacon burger with seven strips of bacon and bacon in the patty and bacon in the bun with a bacon ice cream sandwich on the side. And it created this culture known as bacon mania. And that then fed into the high-end dining world and fed into the independent restaurants and the chefs cooking Brussels sprouts with bacon or kale with bacon. And products like bacon salt and bacon mayonnaise, which don't even have any bacon in them, don't even have any pork on them, but it feeds upon the desire for things that taste like bacon, smell like bacon, look like bacon, to the point where you get, you know, people selling coffins that look like bacon and cars.
Coffins that look like bacon. People have bought coffins that look like bacon? Yeah, $3,000.
For $3,000, you can enter the holy afterlife in a coffin that looks like bacon. Or for a couple other dollars, you can get lip gloss that tastes like bacon, or even a personal lubricant that smells and tastes like bacon.
Right. So this has happened. This is sort of the opposite way these trends usually go, right? I mean, this really came – I mean, talking about something going from a fast food trend and then trickling down to all, you know, food trucks and all over usually you get kind of small artisan products, right, that kind of bubble up among the food intelligentsia and then those kind of make their way up the food chain.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you know, trickle up or down, however you want to put it. It generally is, you know, the creative impulse of some chef or cook or person who's sort of thinking about a product that becomes popular, and as word spreads, it becomes copied and imitated. So if you think about the success of Mission Chinese Food in San Francisco, you know, what they did in the initial food cart and then the sort of pop-up restaurant that grew into the restaurant, now several restaurants, has spurned this demand for a growing number of restaurants that are doing kind of nouveau, hip, urban Chinese food, not traditional sort of Chinatown food or a classic immigrant Chinese food, but this interesting, slightly westernized but modern spin on it, which you're now seeing at a number of restaurants popping up across the continent. And so that's the typical way that happens until, you know, a few years from now, there'll be sort of a Chinese style spicy bean paste that's being packaged at Costco, or some of the flavors and dishes and influences from a restaurant like that Mission Chinese started will become, you know, a flavor of sub at Subway or a flavor of Doritos or something at a TGI Fridays or a Cheesecake Factory. You know, the Kung Pao pastrami will be eventually, you know, a dish that they'll have at Friendly's.
Now, how much of this has to do with, you know, that these things happen so fast, the ideas they spread, the chefs that you're talking about, maybe a strong, popular chef and food gets known. I mean, how much of this has to do with the food media? There are so many food bloggers now. There are all these food magazines. When you look at something, the Cronut is the big example from New York, right, that just started and was international in just a tiny amount of time. How is that media? Is that culture? What's happening?
It's definitely a bit of both. I mean, this is a modern phenomenon. This is the Cronut. What amazed people about the Cronut, and I think what—
Describe what, the Cronut first. Not
the Cronut. The Cronut is a hybrid pastry that is a mix between a croissant and a donut. It was invented last May, 2013, I think May 10th, by this chef, French pastry chef in New York called Dominique Ancel, who has his own bakery in Soho. He debuted it on the 10th. By, you know, the end of that week, there were, you know, 200-person lineups around the block waiting to get them before they sold out at, you know, 7 in the morning. There were Cronut delivery services that popped up. Within a week, he had trademarked the name Cronut. Within 2 weeks, there were people selling quote-unquote Cronuts or Dosants or Croissants or whatever variation on the name they could do to get around the trademark everywhere in the world, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, around New York, in Toronto where I live, in Beijing, in Melbourne, Australia, in the Philippines, in London and Paris, wherever. Wherever there were people, you know, there were sort of knockoff Cronuts in Venezuela, I think. And by the end of August of last summer, or even the beginning of August, you know, there were 200 Dunkin' Donuts in South Korea that were serving a New York pie donut. So this thing just took off like gangbusters. And I think the fascination that people have with talking about it and discussing it and having opinions on it and writing about it and blogging about it wasn't that, oh my God, this is the most delicious food in the world, which it was a very delicious food, but it's, you know, a flaky pastry that's been fried and stuffed with dough, cream. It's not rocket science. It's the fact that this thing spread virally. It spread like a cat video on the internet. You know, it was not constrained by geography or the need of people to actually taste it. Those people in China didn't have to fly to New York, buy a bunch of Cronuts, fly them back to Beijing and reverse engineer them. They just read 300 stories about them within a week from every single media outlet around the world and every single Twitter feed and Instagram and Yelp story that was out there. And so the Cronut is a great example of how the food trend has evolved in the way that it spreads. It starts bigger, it grows quicker, and it dies out quicker because there is so much talk and culture and media around food these days.
No, go ahead.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
No, well, just what is that? Why all that interest? Like, what is it about these food trends that just makes people gobble up news about them?
I think it says something a lot about our culture. Food is the most accessible form of culture we have because everybody eats. Everybody can relate to it in a way that everybody can't relate to music or certain types of visual art. You know, everybody has some knowledge around food. Everybody can appreciate that a you know, a croissant dough donut that's been stuffed with cream and deep fried is going to be delicious and interesting. And it says so much about – food says so much about who we are in terms of our culture, in terms of our ethnicity, in terms of our income, that there are a million ways to interpret any sort of story about food trends, whether it's a high-end trend like – you know, discussing, you know, something that Thomas Keller's doing at the French Laundry, or whether it's an accessible sort of everyday proletarian trend like bacon, right? The bacon burger at Burger King or the bacon menu at Denny's for $2.99. There is an access point for everyone into the culture of food. And what's really happened in the past two decades is that once upon a time, there was only a few places where this was discussed. It was discussed in the newspaper and sort of the home economics section, or it was discussed by the gourmands and the epicures and sort of the high-end people who read Gourmet magazine or had James Beard cookbooks or, you know, ate at Chez Panisse. But today there are endless channels and access points for food media, whether it's, you know, Rachel Ray and Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives or Top Chef or, you know, specialty foodie magazines that are sort of artisanal journals produced in Portland. There's something for everybody. And as it's grown, the appetite for more outlets and more sort of stories and more interesting new cultural experiences, which are really what sort of food trends are, has grown with it.
We're talking about food trends with David Sachs, author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. We want to hear from you. Is there a food trend you love, one you find ridiculous? We also want to hear your predictions. What do you think the next big food thing will be? Join us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. In food predictions, we want people to come up with what's, my one thought is the gourmet jalapeno popper. I imagine it's probably been done.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's my trend spotting moment. But you talk a lot about this. There's a big industry that's out there trying to predict food trends. There's obviously a lot of money in this. I love you. You follow one person who uses chaos theory. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, her name is Susie Badaracco. She runs a small company, a consulting company called Culinary Tides, which is in Portland, Oregon. And Susie originally started her career as a criminologist in the Orange County Sheriff's Department, and she was doing blood spatter recognition and sort of predictive analysis using military intelligence techniques to sort of say, okay, who is this serial killer? You know, it was very, very much like Dexter. Not that she's a killer, but she's a killer when it comes to serial killers in terms of Lucky Charms. Anyway, she pulls, thousands of points of information out of all different sources, media stories, government statistics, academic studies that are being published on a daily or monthly basis. Statistics like where are people traveling or where are they importing food from or what countries are in the news, right? And she pulls that down through various algorithms and data analysis to sort of say, okay, this is sort of on the upswing, this is on the downswing, bet on this, don't bet on this. And she does this for huge food companies like Nielsen, like Cadbury, like Frito-Lay, like McDonald's, for example, to sort of say, listen, this is where you should be looking, this is where you shouldn't be investing. Don't invest in kale salads, but start looking into broccoli or start looking into these types of flavors.
Well, go ahead.
No, there's an entire industry with, hundreds of people and firms that do this, a lot of them based in San Francisco and the Bay Area, actually, with all different methodologies. So other ones are sort of on the ground and employ anthropologists who go out and, look at what people are eating, go into ethnic grocery stores and say, okay, this is an interesting thing that's happening in, Thai grocery stores in the San Fernando Valley or somewhere.
And there's also
– this is what you could be looking at.
And there's also kind of the big, more broad economic cultural forces, right? There are foods that we eat in that are trendy in recessions, and there are foods that are trendy in recoveries.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that Susie Badaracco talked about, and is that, when things are good and our pockets are feeling flush and we feel secure, we're more apt to try new, interesting, risky foods.
Okay, that's when we forage for mushrooms, right?
Exactly. Forage for mushrooms or try crazy modernist cuisines with foams and gels and different disappearing things. But when things are bad, when there's a time of conflict or when the economy is in recession or recovering from recession, we are much more hesitant. We go towards things like cheeseburgers and mac and cheese and cupcakes, which are familiar to us, which are comforting. They're sort of our edible security blankets.
Well, then talk about cupcakes, because that was a big that sort of says food trends to a lot of people. Just the amount of excitement about cupcakes and how long that trend lasted. And there are a lot of good reasons for it. They're adorable and they're delicious. But it's interesting that they really popped in New York after 9/11. They are a comfort food, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, the Magnolia Bakery, which is the sort of bakery that really started this gourmet cupcake trend and the new cupcake trend, and took cupcakes from being something that was a kid's food to something that was sort of permissible for adults and even desirable for sort of young, single women. It was like the edible high heel shoe. That happened because there was a cameo for 20 seconds on one episode of Sex and the City. But I think the bigger force, again, was this that episode happened to air in 2000. And so as the cupcake trend was starting, 9/11 happened and everybody sort of went back into their own little personal shells and wanted things that were comforting and American and sort of this wonderful warm memory of when things were simpler and easier. And what was a better symbol of that than a cupcake, right? It represents the happiest point of childhood when cupcakes appeared in front of your face. So so it really grew on the back of that. And of course, it had its fundamental strengths. They're dead simple to make. Anybody can make them. They're very economical to make as well. And they're made from ready-made ingredients. But you can position them in any way. You can do vegan cupcakes. You can do gluten-free cupcakes. You can do kosher cupcakes. You can do homespun classic artisanal cupcakes, or you could do wild, crazy creations with, you know, 3D printed animal character cupcakes. You could do mini cupcakes. You could do gigantic cupcakes. You can do stuffed cupcakes, and on and on and on and on and on. And I remember going to a Yelp event in San Francisco a number of years ago, and there was five cupcake companies, and each of them was doing a slightly different thing, and people were lining up to taste it because it was a new way of injecting life into this trend that people weren't ready to give up and weren't ready to sort of toss aside, that they still liked cupcakes. And cupcakes also were a way for them to explore all different things.
Yeah, it's funny, too, the cupcakes you kind of point out in your book, that it's interesting that this little cake became a symbol for sort of independent, sophisticated, a skinny woman even, you know, because of Sex and the City, it was sort of you can buy this piece, you can buy a dessert that represents your independence, and somehow that's a cupcake.
Yeah, you've come a long way, baby. Mm-hmm. Eat your cupcake, you know. It is the Virginia Slim of pastry.
Absolutely. Well, we are talking about food trends with David Sacks, author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. We do want to hear from you. We're asking for food trends you love, ones you find ridiculous, and we want to hear your predictions. What do you think the next big food thing will be? You can reach us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email them to forum@kqed.org or post them to our website, kqed.org/forum. We're going to get right to your calls, which are lining up after the break. But in terms of predictions, David Sacks, where do you think this is headed? What's coming in next, or what do you think is hot now and is about to crash?
You know, I see in the same way that I see sort of places like Mission Chinese really starting this new wave of new Chinese food in America for a new generation, I think you're going to see more of the same with Indian food, and especially in the Bay Area. There's, you know, the success of dosa already, but there's a number of restaurants around the West Coast that are doing this. And I think you'll see sort of hipsterfied Indian street food becoming a big thing pretty soon. And I think that something like the gluten-free diet for people who don't actually have gluten sensibility is going to wane somewhat.
All right. And we will take up health trends after the break, and we'll get to your calls. Talking with David Sacks, author of The Tastemakers. We'll be right back. I'm Judy Campbell. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell. We're talking about food trends with author David Sacks. And let's go right to the phones and hear what listeners have to say. Elaine in San Anselmo, join us. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Hi, David. And thank you for taking my call. I see three different trends, at least that I'm interested in. One is tea, using matcha green tea powder. Other teas, I know people started off with Earl Grey, but using hibiscus ground powder.
Is this in desserts or in
savory?
Yes,
in desserts. Mm-hmm. in desserts, into cakes. It's really big. I was recently living in Bangkok, and it was like everything matcha, black sesame as well, which you can use as a tea. They made cakes, jelly rolls. A second thing is still the vegan, having vegan ice creams and unusual types of vegan ice creams, not just using coconut milk or cream or xanthan guar gum and all that, but using cashew nuts, using just like three ingredients to make an ice cream. And the third thing is unusual flavor pairings. I'm very interested in and have been scouting it out in San Francisco, you know, again, hibiscus with like pink peppercorn or matcha with pistachio, and it goes on and on and on.
Are these ice cream flavors you're naming here? Or
It could be.
Yeah.
It could also be, mostly I see them in cakes. They could be ice creams. I make them with, you know, all different things up in the house. You can even do, I just recently saw on Bon Appetit, hibiscus smoothie with a tapioca little balls, you know, the,
right.
I can't think
the
of
little...
what, bubble teas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just all of these unusual, like, Asian-influenced flavor pairings. What do you think about that, at least for the Bay Area?
I think you're dead on the money. I mean, I saw at the Fancy Food Show a few weeks ago, which is the big sort of industry trade fair for fine packaged foods, the type of stuff you get at Whole Foods or at Dean & DeLuca, a ton of matcha products. So matcha teas, obviously, but also matcha cookies, matcha powders, matcha baked goods. The vegan ice creams, obviously, it's a segment that keeps growing because there's a significant portion of people out there who want these things, not just vegans. But, for example, my friends came up to our house the other weekend, and they were kosher, and they don't eat dairy after eating a meat meal. And so we had to buy vegan ice cream, and we bought the coconut stuff, which actually was awful, to be honest. But, you know, maybe the cashew flavor or the cashew milk would have been better. And so I think, again, there are people who want that either for their own personal health reasons or weight loss reasons or just for something different. And then the flavor pairings for sure is this growing sector. As our taste becomes more varied, as we're exposed to more international cuisines, as we travel more, as other cuisines trend like Thai and Vietnamese and Korean, for example, and South Asian, things become popular that before weren't, and we become more open to those interesting flavor pairings, spicy and sweet, or things like, you know, black sesame and sugar, brown sugar, something like that. So I think you should work as a trend spotter.
Yeah, nice work, Elaine. So online, we have Haley writes, predicting food trends, banh mi are going to blow up, and I think ice cream sandwiches are about to pop off just like cupcakes did. What do you think of that one?
I don't know what it's like in the Bay Area. The banh mi. So I was living in New York. Well, I was living in New York between 2008 and 2010, and there were gourmet banh mi places all over. And it was amazing. And when I moved back to Toronto in 2010, which has a very sizable Vietnamese population, I was like, why is this not happening? Someone needs to open a place. Well, soon enough, these guys did, called Banh Mi Boys, whose family was actually the family that makes the majority of the banh mi rolls for the banh mi stores in Toronto. And they did the kind of hip, Chipotle-style banh mi restaurant, which is now, I think, on its third location. They're doing gangbusters. And so you can see that in sometimes it does take a while for it to enter different markets where it would naturally take off. I have heard about the ice cream sandwich thing. I think there's no reason why it shouldn't be a trend. Everybody loves ice cream sandwiches. They're delicious. Maybe ice cream banh mi. Maybe that's the key.
Right. And there is something to this foods from childhood. I mean, to maybe starting with the cupcakes. But there is a lot of love for things that maybe people stopped eating at 10.
Well, it's a lot easier for you to get people excited about something that they're already familiar with. Hey, we've taken the ice cream sandwich you love and we've made it better. We've improved on it by giving it, you know, better quality ingredients and more variety of cookies and ice creams.
And nostalgia makes things taste better, right? Probably.
Exactly. Nostalgia. You know, you remember the ice cream sandwich from childhood, this is what it's going to be like.
And
but
it's
introducing something, you know, foreign and different, like this is a matcha, tapioca smoothie, is a lot more difficult because you have to educate people about what matcha is, what tapioca is, what it tastes like.
You know, right.
People are still hesitant about ingesting something that they don't know what it is.
Well, you can't talk about food trends in San Francisco without talking about the $4 piece of toast that people love to love and ridicule, and is a you know, is a taste from childhood as well. A warm piece of toast is a delicious taste of childhood. We have a short video on local food trends on our website, kqed.org/forum, and we're going to hear this clip. This is from Josie Baker, co-owner and head baker of The Mill, talking about the popularity of his bakery's artisanal toast.
Within a few weeks, you know, people are coming in and saying, is this the place with the toast? I'm like, what? Yeah. Who are you? How'd you hear about this? And so by the time we opened up our doors officially, we already had a following of regular customers who came in for our toast. We've made the best bread that we know how to make. And then we've taken the best spreads and toppings that we can find and paired them up. It's all very simple stuff.
Toast, has it spread, has that one gone nationwide yet?
I think it's still largely a West Coast thing from my understanding. I've only encountered it in San Francisco and Los Angeles. But I can't see why it wouldn't. You know, essentially it's an extension of the artisan baking movement, right? So everything from Ace Bakery in the East Bay to Sullivan Street Bakery in New York and all the places in between. People are buying better quality bread and baking better quality bread. But, you know, if you're a business owner and a bakery owner, you got to think at some point, hey, you know, I could probably make a lot more money if I'm selling this by the slice than if I'm selling them the entire loaf. You know, and if I can add a little value by putting some interesting new spread on it, then, you know, I could probably even charge twice as much.
Andrew writes, I hate the fact that there are food trends. One guy does a chocolate lava cake. Everybody has to do a chocolate lava cake. One gal makes a crab, avocado, and fruit salad. Everybody has to do one. When I go to a restaurant, I want to have something unique to that place. Otherwise, why not go to a faceless chain? Are we really unable to do anything unless a million other people do it? Yuck.
Well, to Drew's comment, I mean, when I first started researching this book, I kind of felt that way. And there was all of a sudden in Toronto an abundance of fish tacos, a tsunami of them, really. You know, there were a couple of hipster taquerias that opened up and specialized in fish tacos. And then, boom, they were everywhere. You could get them at the Blue Jays game. You could get them at every sort of cheap knockoff chain pub that was around the city. And while a lot of those fish tacos were bad, it also created a market where you can now get a fish taco everywhere, whereas before you couldn't. And there were a lot of great fish taco places opening up. But it also pushed people into, okay, what other types of tacos are there? What other type of Mexican foods are there? What other type of Latin American foods are there? Food trends, you know, you could compare it to the tech boom in San Francisco. This is sort of a local analogy, but for all the annoying things that happen with them, for all this talk of, oh, everybody's sheep, everybody's sort of following along, they push our culture forward and they create economic opportunity. So all those places that are creating, you know, chocolate lava cakes are employing bakers and employing wait staff and employing dishwashers. And as long as they're generating money, they're helping the local businesses and the economy and the tax base. But they're also pushing the idea of what we want and our cultural expectations forward, right? It's saying, okay, if you liked lava cake, what else, what other things are out there? What else can we do? If you liked Indian food, maybe we should start looking at Burmese food. Maybe we should start looking at Hmong food, for example. And so, you know, to say, oh, I hate food trends, you have to sort of dial that statement back and say, well, what would a world be like without food trends? We'd all still be eating roast beef and sort of mashed potatoes, I think. I mean, it would be, you know, we wouldn't have new foods and new flavors. We'd just sort of be eating the same things that our parents ate. And I think there's very few of us that want to go back to that world.
You quote in your book, Chef David Chang calling food trends dangerous. He said they spark innovation and they kill innovation.
And I think, you know, in the world that he's talking about, which is really sort of in the professional kitchen, that's true. So what Drew was saying, you know, there's truth to that, absolutely. When you go to an interesting restaurant in the Mission and they're serving the same dishes as the next interesting restaurant in the Mission, you know, oh, you guys have a pork belly dish with braised kale? Wow, we do too. Or, you know, or some sort of
the painterly beet salad that came out on there has been
a... or the artisan toast, right? It's like, come on, guys, do something original. And there is this idea, you know, if you're a chef and you're a restaurateur and you put a lot of money into this business, you want something that's going to sell, right? You want something that people are going to walk in and say, oh, I'm going to have the fish taco because that's something that's familiar. And so there's a temptation to do this. But each one of them is putting their own spin on it. Each one of them is tweaking it and adapting it. And they're also putting out dishes that are sort of individual and interesting. And you can only follow trends for so long before sort of the momentum of that trend peters out and you have nothing to sort of latch onto. So, of course, there's going to be this culture of you know, herd mentality in the same way that, you know, we talk about the tech space again, you know, one app sells for $1 billion and 30 other people go and try to make a similar app. Most of those are going to fail, but some interesting things may come out of it.
Yeah. Well, here's another hit on food trends. A listener writes, waiting in line for over an hour to chase down a trendy new formula of sugar, satin, fault. Sugar, salt, and fat sounds more like a desperate search for novelty by those wallowing in a shallow existence of predictable routine, a surrogate for authentic experience for the comfortably complacent. Ouch. Nuts, wow. Logan writes in San Francisco, nuts are so popular right now, but in California's drought, it's hard to justify buying local nuts, which require so much water to grow. Curious if you found in your research any cases of food trends being forces of good. For instance, food trends that happen in response to drought, climate change, deforestation, etc.
You know, one of the interesting things when you think about the slow food movement, sort of local organic food, is that it was originally a political idea, right? The idea of organic farming really came out of sort of British colonialists who were in India in the 1930s and 40s and saw that soil degradation and water health was better without the use of pesticides and artificial fertilizers. And this movement was taken up by people who cared about the environment, you know, sort of post Rachel Carson and Silent Spring, saying we need to stop these things. You know, they would protest. It was, you know, the type of people who would take up these activist causes, people in Berkeley, for example, and sort of say, you know, you need to eat organic because it's better for the soil and it's better for the health. But it never really took off as a large-scale practice until it became a food trend, until people like Alice Waters started cooking with organic produce and pushing it, or Deborah Madison or other chefs, Thomas Keller, for instance. And people said, oh, I ate it, you know, the French Laundry, and he only uses organics, and we should only use organics because it's the best tasting food. You know, when people talk about organics now, they never talk about soil health and soil degradation. Nobody even cares about that. But you can buy organic produce now at Walmart and at Costco, and places like Chipotle are using organics. It has enough scale now that it's actually making an impact on the environment, which was its original cause. But only when it became a food trend was it able to sort of create the scale to have that impact, because the people who are buying organics aren't doing it for the good of the environment. They're doing it because they believe it tastes better. And I'm talking about the majority of people who are buying organics. And the same thing with local food, right? It was this idea of, you know, your carbon impact and supporting local agriculture and supporting local economies. But again, when chefs like Alice Waters and Thomas Keller and Deborah Madison and so forth talk about, you know, local, they began pushing this narrative that local food tasted better. You know, I remember reading The Omnivore's Dilemma, and Michael Pollan talked about, you know, all the economic consequences and the social consequences and the environmental consequences of eating local. But what stuck with me and what stuck with readers and what sticks with diners is the fact that those strawberries that are coming from, you know, just near Sacramento are going to taste better and fresher and more delicious than the ones that are trucked in from Chile. Or in my case, the ones that are coming from just outside Toronto are better than the ones that are coming from outside Sacramento, because they're fresh and they're local. And you right. can taste this, of course. And, you know, that plays out directly. And so when that happened, people began buying local food because it was a food trend, because they saw it on the menus of local restaurants, which, again, didn't particularly care about their environmental impact. They were doing it because it was trendy to eat, because it tasted better. It delivered right. a better food experience.
Okay. Mark joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Join us.
Yeah, I had a quick question for you regarding these the new trend of food kits everywhere. And they come in all sorts of styles, whether it's pre-cooked or pre-measured, cook it yourself. Tons of waste every time you get one delivered, whether it's, well, I should say, some of the brands like the Blue Apron or whatever. Just wanted you to comment on where all that's going.
So these are food kits that help you. They give you the ingredients, and then you cook them at home?
Well, you cook them at home, or they come pre-cooked, like Munchery.
Okay.
And right. It's kind of interesting. It's getting very, very popular. And, you know, just kind of a food professional's overview. I don't really know. I'm a photographer, but I just think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I see them popping up everywhere. But I also saw tremendous waste.
Yeah.
When this stuff is delivered, it comes in a huge styrofoam box and talking,
right.
You know, right on the heels of talking about the environment and so forth of your previous call.
Right.
Just curious about that.
Yeah, David Sachs, convenience and waste.
I don't know too much about the that market, to be honest, Mark. You know, I know the diet delivery services have been around for a while. I think it's an evolution of the convenience eating trend, which had people, you know, eating TV dinners in the 1950s and microwaved lean cuisines in the 1980s. And this does, you know, attempt to appeal as a more virtuous element of that, right? This is fresh food. This is real food. We're not using preservatives. We deliver real, actual food to your door. Obviously, the packaging element of it is a concern. And I think, you know, it provides an opportunity for companies to address that. I know a couple of companies that do it that are, you know, our packaging's biodegradable, our packaging's reusable. You know, give us your own Tupperware and we'll package it for you. But it's interesting to see how certain trends, which is, you know, the larger trend of convenience eating, especially for singles, urban singles, evolves in different ways, right? Once upon a time, it was all about, you know, this is something that was freeze-dried and easy and you could preserve it forever and microwave it. And now people want fresh, people want local, people want seasonal, but they don't necessarily want to have to go, you know, chopping up their kale and de-stemming it. They want it all prepackaged and ready to go. And so, you know, if there is a substantial concern by people who are buying this stuff that, you know, this is great, but I wish it would come with a lot less styrofoam and plastic, the companies will respond to that. You know, they know that if that's something that people care about, then, you know, they can charge a little more for it and gain a bigger customer base.
We have an email from Victor who writes on next food trends as stores start supporting and promoting local, we'll inevitably start to see true regional dishes. And online, a listener writes, with the advent of social media, a good deal of the restaurant business has fallen under the sway of a certain breed of publicity-hungry wunderkind chefflings. Witness the rise of stunt food. The kind of over-the-top taste experience that is less of an actual dining experience and more of can-you-believe-this type of shock cuisine. Stuff like quadruple bacon-baking cheeseburgers with donut buns are the kind of fare that's designed for maximum tweetability rather than actual culinary satisfaction. It's something you eat on a dare, then share as widely as possible to your social media circle. It's an interesting question, David Sachs, because there's food that's great to take a picture of, and that doesn't mean that it's food that tastes great or that it's a reasonable thing to eat.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting email. You know, it goes back to what David Chang talked about in the book, which is and another person I spoke to, Michael Whiteman, who is a restaurant consultant, but was, you know, had been in the restaurant business in New York and behind some of the great restaurants in New York for decades, and he said, you know, this has created an incentive for chefs. To cook food that can grab attention, right? It's not about roasting, you know, the perfect chicken. It's about, you know, roasting that chicken after it's been sous vide in a, you know, broth of mussel shells and sriracha paste. Again, it's you know, it's like cooking hashtags. And it happens at the high end. So think, you know, molecular cuisine, this food that is impossible to reproduce at home and this incredible experience, but it doesn't necessarily taste great or satisfy. It's almost like a magic show. Two things like the, you know, quadruple bacon bone marrow stuffed hot dog donut. That's the incentive that that this world of food media and sort of the market for food trend creates. And you're going to get a lot of those things, but you're also going to get a lot of delicious things that come out of that. You're going to get people who understand balance and understand beyond just sort of this attempt to create stunt dishes, what can be an enduring thing that's delicious. And so so out of that, that's all part of it. I mean, that you need those types of things in order to make the delicious things that you'll eat every day.
Yeah. What do you think the kind of the competitive food world does to sort of the way that we eat or approach food? I mean, there's something really intimidating about all these food. Well, one, about just reading a food truck's menus, everything. Because there's a lot of clever food. And then watching food shows. People watch so many shows on TV with very complicated dishes. And then people aren't really cooking that much at home. Do you think there's kind of an inverse relationship of cooking and food porn or reading about food?
Yeah, I mean, food has become entertainment, right? And so reading about food, watching TV shows about food, talking about food, tweeting about food, yelping about food, that's all part of it. But in the same sense, people are cooking more and they're more interested in interesting flavors and ingredients. You know, you can get better quality food at your Safeway today than you probably could have got at Whole Foods 30 years ago.
Right.
And that's because, a rising tide lifts all ships in the food world. And so while that idea of cooking for entertainment and cooking as sport, cooking as culture and that kind of foodie culture can seem excessive, it educates more people about what it's like to eat. And so people will talk about things like organic food or local food who may not have even considered it before because they picked it up somewhere.
All right. I just wanted to squeeze in more calls.
Yeah.
All sure. Right. Let's go to Nick in Palo Alto. Hi, Nick.
Hey, guys. Thank you. I love food trends, and in particular, I really like beverage trends as well. And
I like cocktails? Or
not necessarily in the cocktail world, but watching the rise of drinks like kombucha, which have become pretty popular. My girlfriend works as a checkout, a checkout person at Whole Foods, and you now see people coming through, not only young, health-minded people, but older people that are interested in probiotics. The similar rise that you may have seen with coconut water and kind of educating the populace on some of the benefits of coconut water that now becomes kind of the new Gatorade or the new health-minded sports drink. And so I wanted to kind of just get you guys' opinion in terms of food drinks like that. And going back to the predictions that you'd asked for earlier, I predict yerba mate is kind of be the next rise.
Yerba mate, yeah. Right, great. Yeah. Hey, thanks, Nick.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Nick, I used to live in Argentina, so I know yerba mate very, very well. I never really loved it, to be honest, but I tell my Argentine friends that I do. Those types of examples are really interesting. I mean, coconut water is the new Gatorade. Mm-hmm. is the perfect sort of parallel in the fact that it's something that starts out as virtuous and healthy, and then the health trend gets pushed so far with sort of claims and boasts and pseudoscience that it then turns out to be as unhealthy for us as a Coke. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks Gatorade is healthy now. It's, sugar water. And the same thing happened with coconut water. It was this wonderful natural thing that you would get on a beach vacation, and it was full of electrolytes and potassium. But then companies marketing it needed to differentiate themselves in Whole Foods from the 30 other brands of coconut water there. So they started doing coffee flavor and pineapple flavor and, all these different things, and it's become another kind of soda, basically. Pomegranate juice was, another great example of this. Health and diet trends are really some of the more dangerous and insidious trends out there because they contain within them the potential to do great harm as people latch on to claims and sort of pseudoscience in order to sell you, acai or goji berries or chia seeds or whatever.
Chia seeds are a big trends. Right, right. Yeah. Okay, let's get to Dale in San Francisco. Dale, join us.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to just point an arrow at the opposite end of the scale here to paraphrase H.L. Mencken. You'll never go broke underestimating the taste of the American public. The trends that I found to be colossal disappointments were probably just a result of marketing, but they certainly came from the shallow end of the gene pool as far as I'm concerned. One was a few years ago was White Castle Burgers. For some reason or other, that got that took off out here on the West Coast for a very brief time, and there's nothing to write home about there. Then came In-Out Burger, which again is you know unremarkable. And the other one that made a big splash was Krispy Kreme donuts. I mean, there's talk about ordinary. But they, you know, again, clever marketing. And also on a recent show on KQED program, I can't remember which one now, it wasn't Forum, they were talking about craft beer. And someone from the Samuel Adams Brewery was talking about how Sam Adams was a craft beer. It's not. It's a contract beer. It's brewed in not only in Boston, but in Ohio.
Hey, we're short on time, so I'm just going to jump in there. But I think that's an interesting thing just briefly to ask you, David Sachs. We're short on time. I mean, there is a trend of this local artisanal, and that's not – and that's being used by enormous corporations too, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in Sam Adams' defense, before they started and became this massive brewery and sort of a conglomerate, they were – you know, one of the early founders of this American IPA craft beer movement. But it's true. You know, Domino's talks about their artisan pizzas these days, and McDonald's has an artisanal bun. So these things can get appropriate and used to sell you whatever you want.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, David Sachs, author of The Tastemakers, How We're Crazy for Cupcakes. And I'm sorry, I've just lost the title. Say your book for me. Crazy for Cupcakes, but fed up with fondues. Thank you so much for being part of our program, David Sachs. And you can check out a video about local and food trends on our website, kqed.org/forum. Forum's produced by Irene Noguchi and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. I'm Judy Campbell. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.